You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Today's podcast is with Madeline Mann, who is an HR and recruiting leader who spun her insider knowledge of the hiring process into an award-winning career coaching empire called Self-Made Millennial. She's got a terrific new book. It's called Reverse the Search: How to Turn Job Seeking into Job Shopping. Enjoy the pod.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Madeline Mann, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. In the introduction to your new book, you talk about a time when you were leading the human resources department at a tech company and you're sifting through job applications that were not good. And you decided that you were going to help people out by actually giving some of these people feedback. How'd that work out for you?
Oh, well, it was terrible. I thought I was going to be job seekers' heroes because you hear time and time again, I wish I knew why I got rejected for that job. So I thought, why don't I give these people feedback? And the response I got was just bashing me, saying, you're wrong. This company is the worst. You know, you don't know what you're talking about, all those things. And the very few people who were nice to me really expected more of, okay, we'll look at my resume again. Okay, hop on a call. Okay, can you give me even more feedback? And it was an absolute dumpster fire.
What did that teach you?
It taught me if I'm going to help people, I need to help people who ask for it. And I've learned that lesson over and over again in my life, is that people are only ready to hear feedback usually when they have asked for it, when they've braced for it.
My friend Kim Scott, who's been on the podcast a bunch and wrote Radical Candor, she says the same thing, which is like, yeah, people aren't going to – they got to know you love them, and you're not going to get that from a recruiter who you've never met. So it's, and that even then, it's tough for people to hear feedback. And what I love in terms of this sort of origin story inside the book is it's you then sort of taking control – of the situation, given the reality of the situation. And I think that that is the theme of the book. I mean, it's essentially this idea of turning job seekers into job shoppers. And so let's talk a bit about that. What's the difference?
So when one thing I saw when I worked in human resources is the employer side, that companies are terrified to make the wrong hiring decision. And so if they do find the right person, they will move mountains to hire that person. They will wait several weeks longer for that person to quit their job and to start. They will extend their budgets $10,000 more. They will go above and beyond in the interview process to convince this person to join. And that is something that I realize a lot of job seekers don't understand. Job seekers are constantly chasing these opportunities, hoping that these companies deign to give them any sort of attention. Whereas job shoppers use this piece of knowledge to their advantage of, how am I going to become that irresistible candidate who's in a league of their own, where these companies start to say, ooh, we can't live without Kelly. We've gone through this entire tiring interview process. If we can only get Kelly to join, then all of our prayers will be answered. And so when you flip that dynamic, opportunities really come pouring in, and it makes the whole search quite fun.
So I read this book a few weeks ago, And we are, we've been in the process of hiring basically a new head of HR. And I was involved in that. I was part of the interview. I think it was her second interview. It was the best interview I've ever seen a candidate give in my entire career. And it was it was so much like she did everything you talk about. And one of the things I loved is she turned it into, she made it a conversation in which we had to participate. Mm-hmm. So she did a thing where she's like, here's who I am in three pictures. And it was basically, I'm a dog mom. I'm a world traveler and I love to dance. And then the next slide was, it's your turn. And she made all of us do the same. And we loved it. And because people love talking about themselves. But it was immediately, it set this thing. And it's not that she couldn't talk for 30 minutes straight, because she could, but it made it just so much more of an enjoyable of a process for us. And I hope to God, by the time this podcast comes out, that she's working for us.
That's so cool. And that really is a big part of this book, is that if we shift from thinking about the interview as I'm going to answer whatever questions Kelly throws out to me at the best of my abilities, to Kelly's my peer. Let's talk, mm-hmm. let's communicate, let's understand what are your challenges in the HR department, and am I the right person to fill them? And do I feel I'm the right person to fill them? And wow, the dynamic shifts.
Let's talk about the five myths of job seeking. So myth number one is, it will be easier if I aim lower.
This one is so common, where if someone's hitting a snag in their job search, they say, why don't I just go for a role that's below my level? Because I'll be super qualified for that one. And companies will say, of course we're going to go with him. And the reason why this is not great is they're forgetting, again, the piece of what's happening inside the company, where companies are very unlikely to hire an overqualified candidate. And if you are overqualified, or if you have a lot of experience, you might have felt this before, where companies know that you're likely just going to take this job as a placeholder until the right job that you actually want, that pays you what you want with the right title, is going to come up. So you're going to be very hard to retain. So shooting lower in your job search is actually harder than going a little bit uncomfortably high with your targeting.
Okay, myth number two, I need to get another degree or certification to stand out.
Unfortunately, when we are in the job search, we look for paved paths. And what that means is, you know, a job search is a road with no signposts. And education has signposts. So we go there. We spend tens of thousands of dollars on this MBA, expecting that is going to magically change our fortune. Or we get that fourth certification for our career path, when really the first certification was all we really needed to hit those qualifications. And so the bottom line is, don't think that additional education is going to fix your job search. It's not going to help you stand out. It might help you meet baseline qualifications, but if that's the case, everyone else has those too. So you need to find other ways to stand out.
I'd also add to this, I can't remember, and I've, you know, I'm how many years into this, like, be 38 in October working here. And I've looked at so many resumes. I'm not hung up on your degrees. I mean, I like that you graduated college, but if it's Pepperdine or it's Loyola or it's Lake Forest College, or, you know, it doesn't Harvard. That's never been the deciding factor in a candidate.
I've never seen it happen either. It might do a little bit, you know, they might look at a little bit of education in the beginning, but I've never seen, in an interview debrief, someone say, well, you know, I think we should go with her because of this certification. And it's like, no.
Yeah, no. All right. Myth number three, the job search is a numbers game. Talk about that.
Oh my gosh. Probably all of us have an aunt or a cousin or a next door neighbor who says, oh, you're having trouble in your job search. Keep going. It's a numbers game. Keep cranking it out. And that is very damaging advice, because mm-hmm. I have proven time and time again with my clients that the job search isn't a numbers game, because if it was, they would have all gotten jobs before they came to me. The people will apply to hundreds, sometimes even thousands of jobs, Kelly.
Oof.
And they won't have landed an interview, much less an offer. And what I found is with these job shopping methods where you reverse the search, you can be interested in a handful of opportunities and land interviews at most of them, and then also land several offers. So it's really about your approach, not about this scatter. And I would say also, I think that this point is more salient today than ever before, because with AI, with the overcrowding of these openings, with these tools that are allowing job seekers to apply to hundreds of jobs a day, you are basically going to the most crowded path. And if it's crowded and it's comfortable, then you're going to get lost in the sauce.
All right. Two more. Myth number four. I need to stay open to many different types of roles so I don't miss out on potential opportunities. I can see why this doesn't work.
Tell me. I mean, with all of your hiring, what have you noticed when someone seems like they're maybe interested in multiple different types of roles? What comes up for you?
All right. This head of HR, I had at least 25 people on LinkedIn who had, and this was the most exhaustive listing ever in terms of here's the requirements. And one of them is you had to have run an HR department for 3 years. Of these 25 people who reach out to me, some of who I knew, none of them had that. And I'm like, that's a bare minimum for a head of HR who has people underneath them. And it was just sort of like, what you like, you don't, this isn't a role that you should go for. And that happens all the time.
What was their, was their background even in HR?
No.
There you go.
No, they like, maybe they did consulting or had clients who were associated with HR. It's like me doing that because I've spoken at HR conferences.
Yes. Yes. And what you're getting to here is that it's terrifying to hire someone like that because you know that they haven't done the hard work to determine mm-hmm. that's the right career path for them. They are mm-hmm. using you or the employer as a career experiment. And you don't want to be that experiment. You don't want to
No.
You don't want to be the one who's saying like, "Oh, you didn't realize that this is a part of the role in HR because you're very untrained in it and now you hate it and now you're leaving and now the team is also leaving because they don't like your leadership." It's a spaghetti mess. And so companies smell this from a mile away and it repels them.
Yeah, this is a thing in improv. So when one of the reasons we teach people in improv when you're in a scene with your scene partner is you don't just ask a bunch of questions because then you're putting the burden completely on the person across from you. Mm. In other realms of life, you should ask a lot of questions. I get that. But in this sort of making something out of nothing together kind of thing, like don't make this like I had to work at responding to your LinkedIn message to me, and I don't want to do that. All right, myth number five, and this is one that is riddled with existential despair, so I think we should feel okay about going there, which is things will eventually become clear and it will all work out.
Kelly, you read the book, so you know that at a certain point, I gave a statistic of when I asked my audience, how did you choose your career path? And 53% of people said, I stumbled into it. And mm-hmm. this to me is so bonkers because it is, besides possibly choosing your spouse, choosing your career path is probably the single most important decision you'll make as far as day-to-day happiness, your financial situation, all that kind of stuff. And most people choose to not choose. And we carry this mentality of even if we chose wrong, that some magical day in the future, it's going to fix itself, that we're going to stumble into the correct thing. And so this one's a swift kick in the pants to say, get out of that mindset and start making actionable moves that are going to move you in the right direction versus just letting the lazy river take you where it may.
All right. I want to tell you how I got into my career and then get your feedback.
Okay.
Feedback
all right. Let's hear it.
So I thought I wanted to be a playwright. And my dad, he was an entertainment guy here in town. He had a radio show and he reviewed theater. So he knew a bunch of people. And I got three informational interviews and all of them said the same thing to me, which is if you want to work in theater, go to work in a theater, whether it's tearing tickets or doing whatever. And one of the three
basically got me a job at Second City. I didn't know what it was going to be. I was just show up on a Friday night, and I got here and I was led to the back bar and I was a dishwasher. So I started as a dishwasher. Then I hosted the room, and then I left to go work for the guy who got me the job was starting a new theater. I worked that theater for a while, came back here, got a job in the box office, and then became the producer of Second City. This is in 1992. Not what I expected to do, but I ended up writing a book, you know, whatever, 15, 20 years later. I love what I've been able to do. But the one thing when I look back at this, and I want to sort of see what you think, was I knew, generally speaking, I wanted an arts career. I wanted to do something sort of creative and exciting, and I was willing to work hard, and I was young. And so I was young, and I was able to take that position and make it work for me. And I ended up where I am today.
Yeah. And I think there's a few things that are interesting there. One misconception is that you must take a job in order to understand if you would like it. And what I like that you did in your path is that you did those informational interviews. You talked to people, you understood, you know, possibly what your trajectory could be, even though it did go in different directions that maybe you weren't expecting. But I think that that's important of look before you leap, you know, talk to people, be a curiosity sponge. And I do think early in your career, you do sometimes just need to take jobs to learn more about yourself more than anything of what do I like. But then as you start asking more questions, really get clear about what are the possibilities out there? What would it look like to take this job? And a lot of times you can figure that out without actually taking it.
So you sort of, in your sort of career arc, you talked about mastering academia, like you knew how to play that game, but that didn't necessarily help you when you moved to the job market.
Yeah, I was a C-minus employee when I was an A-plus student. And really, it's because I lived my life with a rubric. If you give me a list of expectations, I will hit every single one while working very hard. I'm not someone who hits expectations easily. I have to really work at things, but I will hit them. And when I came to the workplace, I would hit expectations, and for some reason I was getting feedback of, you know, threes and twos out of five in my feedback for my jobs. And when this becomes even more acute is when you look at the job search, where we apply to, say, universities. There's a deadline. You can see the typical scores you're supposed to get, typical GPA you're supposed to have, and you hear back in a timely manner, and then you choose what you want to do. With companies, all that goes out the window, especially corporate companies, like where it's not in academia, it's not in more of a structured government environment. The people who kind of skirt the process, or you kind of buck the convention, end up landing more job opportunities and are seen as more appealing. And so once I realized that, a whole world of possibilities opened up. And that's really how so many of my clients are able to land so many opportunities, is by tapping into a lot of these less known paths.
And I imagine, too, you talk in the book, you say, quote, knowing what you want will make you happier, end quote, which I agree with. That's a lifelong process. I don't think that that's a static thing. I think what I wanted at 21 and 22 is very different than what I want at 58 or 59.
Absolutely. And I think that you need to keep revisiting it. But I'm sure you hear all this stuff, and maybe it's something that really resonates with you, but there's all these things about manifestation, right? Of things come to you. It's not something that I've deeply studied, but as far as what I know, is the best way to get what you want is to know what that is and tell people. And I think that that's a core principle of manifestation. And so it's not even woo-woo. It is truly a psychological principle where if I tell you, look for everything, you know, blue in your background, suddenly your eye is going to go to everything blue. It's the same with career success and unearthing these opportunities. I was just on a client call the other night with a bunch of my clients. One person said, yeah, I was getting my nails done. And my nail technician knew someone at the company I was interested in working for and was able to make an introduction. You would never think about that. But because my client knew what she wanted, and I told her to intentionally log as many interactions in a day as possible where she's talking about her career and talking about her job search in a very normal way, not in like an antagonistic, listen to me kind of way, she was able to unearth an amazing referral. And so that is something that I think is so important for us to get what we want.
In chapter four, you talk about this memorable video resume that you got. I was reading that and I'm like, oh my God. So this happened, I don't know, maybe 2 months ago. We don't do a ton of video casting, you know, but we were doing understudy roles and we told people to send in tape. And Claudia Wallace, who was our casting director here, called me in her office like, you've got to look at this. And 90% of this tape was the person who's auditioning arguing with her partner who was trying to help her and clearly sent the wrong link.
Oh my gosh.
It was like something out of Waiting for Guffman. It was just so funny, but also like, you really should check before you send what that attachment is going to be.
No. Oh my gosh. That is so awful. Yeah. I think that is a hilarious story. And really the idea behind that video was, we have to get in the mind of who is watching. And we often think that a video or a cover letter is about us, but it's not. It's not about us. Our introduction is actually not about us. It is about what value we can add to the end viewer. And so I think we get too caught up in this autobiography syndrome where we're telling our own story and we're getting caught up in all the details when really it's about really sussing out what are the key details that is going to make the company say, oh, okay, they get us. They understand us. They know they have what we need.
Yeah. In the parlance of improvisation, that's being others focused, you know, put your attention on the other person and then speak from there. I want to tell you about an improv exercise that we have, which I think will resonate with you based on the thing you write about in the book. We have an improv exercise called Justin Little. So we pair up two people and we say to one person, tell this other person an accomplishment of yours or basically what your career has been. And they do that. They go, okay, the other person, now you're going to repeat that back to them, but you're going to insert the words just and little throughout and see how that makes you feel.
Oh my gosh, that's so mean.
It's very mean. We have them do it to each other. But also part of that is you need to feel what it is like when you, what you call it, I just syndrome.
Yep.
And because you're doing it to yourself or you do it to other people. In either case, not good.
Yes. That is I just syndrome. I did a talk at Cal Poly Pomona a few months ago, and I just syndrome was the number one thing that people came up to me and talked to me about from my talk. And it's really this idea that we are often the first ones to dismiss our experience. Oh, well, I just was a part of the team. I didn't actually lead that project. Oh, I just did that as a part of my spouse's business. I wasn't actually paid for it. Oh, I just did that pro bono, whatever it is. I just. And you have to stop and say, no, you added real world value and stand on that. Really claim it and observe it that way. We can't be the first ones to diminish what we've done.
All right. I think my favorite line in the book comes in chapter six. You say, quote, I am mildly begging you here. Please trust me when I ask you to network. Your happiness is on the other side of relationship building, end quote. Couldn't be more true.
Oh my gosh. Well, especially, I mean, if you really understand the entertainment industry, I mean, that's a huge part of making your way through the industry is the relationships.
Every industry. And also, the science is pretty clear on this, that happiness over life is based on those relationships that you have. And those relationships, it's not that they're all harmonious all the time and perfect all the time, but you're in relationship because we don't do this alone. And as you get older, it's not that things get easier, but you accumulate more people into your universe and you have more people you can call. If I have an issue on something, I almost always have someone I can call. And I'm a natural networker. That's, you know, but I'm married to someone who isn't, who's my wife is brilliant and she's a great teacher. And so she's got tons of people, but it's harder for her, but it's almost like she took the teaching gig to help her do the thing that she knew she needed to do, which was maintain these connections. And there's a thing called Dunbar's number, which is 150, which is we can't really have more than that in terms of people who are going to sort of effectively be, but that's fine. You don't need more than that.
Yes. And I did a book club with several hundred people who had read Reverse the Search. We did a virtual book club and I put up a poll of how do you feel about networking? And over 40% of the people there answered. And there was all kinds of different ways. If I feel nervous, I feel clueless, I don't know what to do. Over 40% people put excited. I feel excited to network. And I go, wait, is this because of the book? And they said, yeah, you made it easy. You made me realize that networking is not this, you know, I'll scratch your back, you know, you scratch mine, please do this for me, give me a job. No, networking is fun. Networking is making friends. Networking is taking an interest in people and helping others. Like so much of networking is just starting with being a good person to others. And so when you start shifting your mindset, it can be fun. And also the opportunities come with that.
So this is interesting. I'm going to thread a needle because I think that people feel that way because the word networking makes it feel like gross or that you're using someone. We have an exercise and I did this last night. I did a interactive keynote for a Kellogg marketing thing up at Northwestern. And I led them through this exercise called Thank You Because. And I've talked about it in the podcast before, but essentially it's like, how do you yes and someone you don't want to yes and? And what you do is you thank them, you know, and you, the because is where you find something of value in what they just said, even though you don't agree with it. And this guy, and this has happened quite a few times to me, that there's one guy who's like, that doesn't feel authentic to me. Like, is it supposed to, I'm like, well, don't get hung up on the words, but also like, I gave you a minor disagreement and you have a problem saying thank you. It's like, what is that? Like what, you know, what is, and I think it's similar to this networking thing, which is like you build up and you start to self-sabotage because it maybe is going to be a little uncomfortable and like, I don't want to go there.
Yes, it definitely is this, there's this fear rooted in it. And I think a lot of it also just comes from this idea of just this worry of feeling annoying. I work with my clients a lot on the art of the follow-up, where I actually reposition a follow-up as a helpful reminder, almost like an alarm someone sets, and it shows that you actually care versus not. Like, for example, if I really wanted to talk to you, Kelly, what would you think if I, first of all, sent you like a really nice personalized email and then you didn't respond because you had tons of things going on and I followed up several times? Would that show to you that I'm an annoying person? Or would that show to you that I did not just blast out this email to thousands of people, that I'm like, no, Kelly, like, I really want to talk to you. I'm spending time on you. Like, I actually really care. You know, I'm going to show you that I spent 15 minutes of my time asking for 15 minutes of your time. So, you know, I guess it's like getting comfortable with that dynamic of the follow-up and the care and the interaction actually increases the relationship versus diminishes it.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one thing is because if you send me on LinkedIn a note that you want to talk to me, but you don't have a headshot in your little thing, I'm not responding to you.
Yeah.
That seems fair, right? I think that's a fair. That's kind of what I do. I'm usually actually I have been in my career very good about that. I have found now it's to a degree where I can't talk to everyone, but I will tell you. A personalized, well-crafted note, whether it's on LinkedIn or not, where I can tell it's not a spam kind of thing, usually I'll respond. I'll respond to that. And I know the difference, and I think most people know the difference. Okay, in a moment, we're going to ask you for a yes and story. Before we do that, I do want to talk to you a little bit about storytelling. Obviously, I work in a storytelling industry. I love science. I love facts. They are meaningless if you can't convey them within a story that people are going to pay attention to.
Absolutely. Storytelling is the cornerstone of rocking the interview. One thing I encourage people to do is they think, oh, of course, yeah, I'm going to tell stories and give examples when they ask me, tell me about a time when, or give me an example of questions. But actually, the people who win in the interview try to tell stories even more often than that. So let's say you're asked, how do you handle high-pressure situations? Most candidates will say, they'll start describing it, right? Of, well, I'm pretty calm. I have a plan. I create a plan. I communicate. Okay. That's a C- answer. What I want to hear is, you know, maybe a one sentence on how you typically are. It's like, for example, and then you dive into an example. And if you're doing this on a more regular basis, when you're asked these questions, it's amazing how much more memorable you will be and how much more they'll be able to picture what it's like to work with you.
I would also recommend always have in your back pocket your funny fiasco. We love to see people who have gone through, you know, a great failure story is going to stick in the mind and is not going to like turn someone off, especially if it's a story well told, which also means you got to practice it. Why do people not practice their interviewing?
Oh my gosh. It is so, they'll write it down and then they'll repeat it in their head. And then the words will come out and they'll be like, wait, this is all gobbledygook. It sounded perfect on the paper and it sounded perfect in my head. Why is this all coming out weird?
Yeah, the practice is hugely important. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
So talk about a terrible time. I, at one point in my career, I was fired, and it was to do a job search after being fired is really tough because you're down in the dumps. You feel awkward about answering question, why did you leave your last job? Because that's a huge question that always comes up. You're just kind of at an all time low. And then of course the little voice about your finances is in the back of your head. And so I'd been fired and so I was picking myself back up. And then I went through this entire interview process and every step of the way, I was absolutely rocking it. It was the exact role I wanted to go for. And I get to basically the end interview and the recruiter says, you got the role. Like they chose you. There was two final candidates. They chose you. And it was just so amazing. I didn't hear them for about a day. And he called me back. He's like, hey, we're just going to have you meet with the VP. She just wants to meet with you before we give the offer so she can sign off on it. I said, perfect. I showed up kind of wearing casual clothes, very, very just kind of laissez-faire, you know, I thought we were going to chat. And then the interviewer's questions were kind of hard. And I just found myself stumbling because I hadn't really prepared for the interview. I wasn't in the right mindset. And then I didn't hear from the company for days. And finally I heard back and the recruiter said, oh, we brought back the other candidate as well. And they ended up giving the offer to the other person. And that just about destroyed me. I knew I'd messed it up and I had all these regrets and the recruiter like almost pretended like he didn't tell me that I'd gotten the offer. And so a couple of days later, I got an interview for another opportunity and I was planning on saying no. And that was the moment where I was like, just no, you know, no yes and. It was a no. Uh-huh. It was a company they didn't even have a job description. They did some technology I didn't really understand. And I just thought, why would I put myself through this? It's probably not even a good opportunity. I don't feel good. But I don't know what pushed me to do it. Maybe just the fear of disappointing people, you know, by agreeing to a meeting and unagreeing to it. But I took it and I just kind of had this, let's just see where this takes me. Don't put too much pressure on yourself idea. And that they did the interview. They're like, you're amazing. Come in tomorrow. And I met the entire team the next day. I blew them all out of the water as far as the interview process. I got the offer and it was the greatest opportunity of my entire life. It was a way better role than what I would have gotten that I got rejected for. It was the role that really set me on my entire trajectory. The reason I'm sitting here talking to you right now is because of this role, because of the confidence and the leadership I built in that role. And it was just this moment of like kind of saying, F it, like, let's go, let's do this. Even though I don't feel ready to show up, courage comes before confidence. So I had the courage, I made it happen, and that completely changed the rest of my life.
I love it. The book is called Reverse the Search, How to Turn Job Seeking into Job Shopping. Madeline Mann, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.